Hello, this is Brian Zimmerman, the custom content editor for Becker's Healthcare. Today, I am pleased to be joined by Dr. Terry Loftus. Dr. Loftus serves as the Chief Medical Officer for Medical City Fort Worth. Dr. Loftus, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it, and good afternoon.
Absolutely. Just to start off, can you introduce yourself to our listeners? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. You know, as you said, I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Medical City Fort Worth, and but I'll just give you a little bit of my background. I wasn't always a Chief Medical Officer. I obviously was a physician and in practice for years. And so I originally trained as a general surgeon at the University of Utah and did a trauma surgical critical care fellowship at the University of Maryland Shock Trauma. And I had worked in trauma for years, and that was really my specialty. And along the way, went back to school, got an MBA, and got enticed to come over to the administrative side and eventually start working as a chief medical officer, where I really kind of got an introduction into understanding kind of the data and the analytics and maybe some of the stuff we're going to touch on a little bit later.
So it sounds like you had a unique path there. And I'm wondering if you can also tell us just a bit about, you know, Medical City Fort Worth.
Yeah, Medical City Fort Worth is one of 16 hospitals comprising Medical City Healthcare. It's really sort of the brand of the North Texas division of HCA in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in North Texas. And so we offer comprehensive diagnostic treatment services and a wide range of specialties. We have a real strong focus in specialty surgery. We serve Fort Worth and the greater Tarrant County and the rural communities of the West Texas. And so we're like a lot of hospitals, but just our primary service line. So focus on neurosurgery, cardiovascular, orthopedics, surgical oncology, bariatrics, transplant, and of course, robotic surgery, which crosses over all of those service lines. In addition to the usual surgical specialties, we also treat complex medical diseases such as COVID-19 with our critical care service, and as well as along with the support of our hospitalists. So we do a fair amount of a little bit of everything.
Great. Well, thanks for setting the stage for us there. And, you know, that your comments bring me directly to my next question, which is, you know, has to do with addressing the topic of the year, really. So what is the situation with COVID-19 at Medical City Fort Worth? And can you just talk a bit about that for our listeners?
Sure. I mean, we've got a great reputation as a surgical specialty hospital. We do a lot of comprehensive care, but we can't ignore the sort of the needs of our community. We also serve a large number of patients presenting to our ED and also being transferred in with COVID-19 and other complex conditions. And we are a leapfrog grade A hospital. So we have the infrastructure to manage this patient population. And we really have had to adapt very quickly to the needs of the community. And so in many ways, we've had to slow down our elective surgery business in order to meet the needs of the community and make sure that we have plenty of resources available for those patients that are coming in with COVID-19. So every day our emergency department, just like everywhere else across the country, is inundated with a lot of patients who are coming in with COVID-19 illness, and we have to treat it. So as you've probably been reading in the media out there and hearing on TV, you know, Texas is experiencing an increase in COVID cases. Demand on us, which we have to figure out how to load balance the other needs of our community, along with the pressing surging needs of COVID-19. And so it's been a real exercise in being flexible in managing to that demand.
Yeah, it sounds like sort of a tricky balance there. And my next question, do you have any sense of what recovery might look like? I mean, the cost of this pandemic just from, you know, this elective surgery slowdown, also what it's, you know, what it's done to clinicians around the country, the trauma of it all. Do you have any sense of what recovery looks like? And, you know, will we be dealing with COVID-19 for years?
You know, I'll tell you, in terms of recovery, I mean, what we are experiencing, particularly over the last 4 months, is, you know, we had prepared for this massive surge that back in March and April. And so what happened was, is we in North Texas, we didn't have quite that surge that we thought we were going to experience. And so we scaled back on our elective surgery, made room, and we saw a dramatic drop off in overall admissions to the hospital, which a lot of hospitals experience in the country and realize that you know, that we had to figure out how to time it, because that was probably the biggest issue in the early portion of it. We were trying to find ways to preserve personal protective equipment and how to preserve our supplies and make sure that we were going to be there and have the beds available to meet that challenge. Well, we kind of, you know, we got a little bit caught off guard, and we had all of those things. We had the PPE, we had the beds, we had the nursing capability. Everything was there except for that big surge in the patients. And so, of course, like everybody else, we thought kind of relaxed a little bit, and where there was some easing that happened within society, and all of a sudden the surge did come. And that's where we're at right now, is scaling up for that. Now, the good news is we learned a lot in this process. We not only learned what was happening in places like New York and Miami and Seattle, we've been able to adjust and learn and adapt to it and be able to scale up pretty quickly. And, you know, I'll tell you, that's one of the nice things that working for a company like HCA is we have a supply chain, we have the whole data analytics and the support services to be able to make that kind of adaptation pretty quickly. And so I think we were fortunate in many regards, because both the East and the West Coast got hit first and really taught us some important lessons, and we're able to adapt to it. But, you know, we're in the mix of it now, particularly Southern Texas is really getting hit pretty hard right now. We're predicted, obviously, to continue to see some of the surge, but so far we've been able to weather it pretty well. And, you know, but every time I look at the data, I keep seeing, okay, maybe it's plateauing, and it just so far hasn't quite plateaued exactly the way we wanted to. So we know we're going to be in it for a long time. In fact, actually, I would say we're going to be in it for years. The thing about a pandemic is different than the typical influenza season is it can cross over seasons and sometimes go on for, you know, 12, 18, 24 months. And so we just have to be prepared for that. We have to understand that that's what we're dealing with. And how do we sort of, like I said before, load balance across that time period and make sure that we meet the needs of the rest of the community, because that's the only way to really deal with the epidemic, or excuse me, with the pandemic. I also think that there's another side of this particular pandemic that's going to impact us as not only a healthcare system, but as a society. And so just if you just think about some of the changes that have happened just in the last few months, you know, and I'll give you just a couple of examples. And, you know, one of them that comes to mind is telemedicine. Telemedicine was, I would say, probably a nice to have in the past. And in overnight, it has really become a must have. You know, as an example, we use telemedicine to provide consultations for our patients who are in our COVID unit. And so physicians will come up, we'll see the patients. But in order to cut down on the PPE and also cut down on the contact time with patients who are positive with COVID-19, we've enabled a televideo service that allows us to interact with patients remotely. And that's really been a big boost. And, you know, I've got to tell you, our physicians, if you would ask me this question pre-COVID, would they be willing to use a televideo conferencing technology? I would have said, you know, probably not. Maybe a few, but most of them won't. And I ran into one of our physicians the other day, and I said, so what did you get a chance to use? And he says, yeah. And I said, what do you think? And he goes, I love it. He goes, I would have never thought about using it. He goes, now I can't live without it. In fact, actually, a lot of our physicians took that same technology and use it now in their clinics to remotely be able to get in contact with their patients. Because a lot of patients just simply don't want to go out and sit in a doctor's office waiting room. They would rather be seen and talk to physicians remotely. And so this technology is changing overnight. And then another one, which I think is also for the better of society, and something, and this is a real simple one, hand washing. You know, probably one of the biggest complaints they used to get before was that, you know, somebody saw somebody not wash their hands or something like that, you know. So we do a lot of audits to make sure people are doing their hand washing, and we do a lot of education and stuff like that. But hand washing, you know, probably one of the most effective ways to prevent transmission of infectious diseases is probably become more ubiquitous in our society now than it ever has been. Just as an example, I was talking to our folks from Environmental Services, and I said, how much hand sanitizer are we using now? And they said, you know, if we compare it to pre-COVID, we are now using 3 to 4 times as much hand sanitizer as we were prior to COVID-19 hitting. And we started to see the hand sanitizer use go up even before we had our first COVID-19 patient. And so all of a sudden, just the knowledge that, you know, that of COVID-19 could be here, people are washing their hands like crazy and going through hand sanitizer, which is a good thing because it ultimately cuts down on the hospital acquired infections and I think also does a lot to prevent the distribution of not only COVID but other potential viruses. So in some ways, it's been a really good thing. I think we're learning a lot of lessons that we probably knew all along, but now we are more motivated to use not only the technology but the existing technology that's been around for a long time that we know that works. So like I said, it's been an eye opener for me, and I think for a lot of people in healthcare.
Yeah, it's definitely been fascinating. I think, you know, especially with regards to like hand washing, like we've all known that's a problem. And now this is like pushing people to really, you know, do better with that, you know, and also thinking about telehealth too. Like, I think there's been a lot of conversation in healthcare about, you know, we've got to meet the patient where they're at. And now it's sort of like, we really have to meet the patient where they're at, right?
Yeah, we have a demand for it. Yeah, it's definitely there.
Absolutely. Okay. So my next question for you then is I want to move and talk a bit more about robotic surgery, because I know that's a key strategy at Medical City Fort Worth. And I'm wondering if you can tell me what is it about robotics that's so appealing, especially, you know, in this current environment?
Well, robotic surgery plays an important role in all of our service lines. And like I said, we're a surgical specialty hospital. So we utilize a robot to support our major surgical service lines. And so we use robots for spine surgery, hip and knee joint replacements, for bowel surgery, prostate surgery, and just all other forms of surgical oncology. And we firmly believe, you know, a minimally invasive approach to surgery provides great benefits. And I know there's been some controversy about this in the past, but I just think in time, what we're beginning to see is that not only do the patients like the outcomes, but the surgeons love the access to the technology. So we've organized our service lines around this technology, and we approach, you know, the approach of robotics is about achieving that improved length of stay and lower complications by organizing around it. So we've also included, along with our robotics program, and this has gone on all across HCA, and that is we've instituted an enhanced surgical recovery program along with our high value service lines. And so enhanced surgical recovery, just to kind of give your listeners just a sense of what it is, it's basically taking things that we know that work really well and applying them in the preoperative, intraoperative, and postoperative period of surgery. And what we're finding is if we consistently deliver on those things that we know that work and improve outcomes, we do see the better outcomes. And so just another couple, two quick, simple examples of it. If we know that after most operations, we can begin feeding patients as early as that first day of surgery, that those patients, their bowels start sooner, and they ultimately end up doing better. We also know that if you begin ambulating patients as early as that first day of surgery and getting them up and moving, that ultimately what you see is a decrease in complications and an overall improvement, not only in length of stay, but also in some cases, you know, readmission rates and things like that. So enhanced surgical recovery is really just the consistent application of known techniques and known processes that work to improve overall company. So if you couple that with a minimally invasive approach like robotic assisted surgery, you get really the synergy between the two. And I really do think that that's really what has been driving these great outcomes, not only of the lower complications, lower length of stay, but reduced readmissions. And so we've seen this as just as key to our strategy of taking care of patients in this community.
So drilling down a little bit deeper into robotic program development, you're known for publishing books on that topic, and you have a seven pillars model, I believe. Could you talk about that model and how it helps hospitals establish successful robotic service lines?
Yeah, I mean, this was tell you the story. A few years ago, I was working for another healthcare system at the time, and I was approached by one of the CFOs, and he just came up to me one day at the corporate office. I had taken on a position there. I was working as their medical director of surgical services, and he just said, you know, can you do us a favor? He said, could you research a simple question for the executive leadership team? He said he wanted to know, is there value in robotic surgery? And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he says, He goes, well, look, we're spending millions of dollars on this technology. And, you know, we hear conflicting reports on it. We're not really sure. Is there true value? Meaning, are we getting the better outcomes, the overall reduced costs associated with the people, some people are claiming for what we're paying for it. And I said, you know what, let me look into it. And it's where it just took me on this probably a good three-year journey to better understand robotic surgery and to learn the answer. And you know, I'm like, I'm a scientist at heart. And so I did what every scientist does. I went to the literature and started looking at it and began to realize the evidence really, I could see why things were confusing. The evidence was all across the spectrum. Some studies showed good outcomes, some showed equivalent outcomes. Everybody was showing that the costs were high, and it really wasn't clear to me. So I dug into our systems data, and I was fortunate enough, our healthcare system had a fleet of robots. We had a ton of data, and I had access to it, and I had people who can do the analytics for me. And so that was a great opportunity for me to learn about what it was that really worked. And just to summarize real quickly, what I learned was that hospitals with an organized approach to robotics were able to get better outcomes at a lower cost than those that are not so well organized. And so I wrote a book called The Robotics Program, A How-To Guide for Physician Leaders on Starting Up a Successful Program. And the reason I did that is because I couldn't find anything out there that, you know, helped and guided people through that, particularly physicians. And so, you know, another story, I was trying to figure out, you know, understand this approach. And I was out visiting one of our facilities, and I went to the hospital and I said, hey, I want to see, show me your robotics program. And they brought me down to the operating room, and the director of the OR brought me into the operating room. And we went into one of the rooms, and he pointed in the corner, and there was a robot. And he says, there it is. And I said, that's your robotics program? He says, yep, that's it. And I said, you mean just the robot? And he goes, yeah, that's it. Is there anything else? He said, no. And I went and I visited another hospital. Same thing. They brought me down to their OR. I got to watch a few cases, and they said, hey, our committee is going to meet. And I went up and we met the committee, and there's a room full of people. It's multidisciplinary. They had agenda, had meeting minutes. They had, they were reviewing things. There was administrators in the room. There was surgeons in the room. There was nurses in the room. There was, people from quality in the room. They were going over data. They were looking at their performance goals. And all of a sudden I went like, this is a program. You know, they don't just have a piece of equipment sitting in their operating room. They organize around it. That's how they're getting the better outcomes. And that particular facility had some of the most outstanding outcomes in the system. And so that was a real wake up call for me. And that's really, you know, sort of like the genesis for the book. And so the seven pillars, just to summarize, they're just purpose, engagement, communication, infrastructure, accountability, leadership, and performance improvement. And that, you know, this, it's a model not just for building robotics program, but can really be used for development of any program. But, you know, I detail it in the book and go into each of the pillars in a lot of detail. But suffice it to say, having an organized approach to a robotics program will produce better outcomes at a lower cost compared to not having an organized approach. And just to give you a little bit of the data, and this data is about 6 years old now, but at the time, what I found was is that if you had a robotics program compared to if you didn't have a robotics program, you had a 46% difference in complications, and that was a risk-adjusted observed to expected ratios difference. And so 46% difference. And when I looked at costs, what I found was that difference between an organized approach to robotics and a less than organized or not organized approach to robotics, there was a 37% difference in the cost. And that was an observed to expected risk-adjusted measure. And so it was pretty clear that you really needed to be organized around it. If you did that, you got the better quality and got the better cost. And so whenever people come to me and say, well, you know, I read this study, and I always say, well, what, you know, tell me about their program, because if it really isn't a formal organized program and they're not getting great outcomes, that may be the problem. And that was really I think another one of the big eye-opening things that I learned in the process.
No, definitely. And those figures around sort of the differences between the costs and outcomes that, you know, the organizations without a formalized program versus otherwise are pretty stark. And so I'm wondering, sort of in the spirit of, you know, getting the most out of robotics programs, in addition to, you know, not being organized as one, perhaps, what would you say are the biggest watch outs or potential barriers for health systems and their robotics programs. Is there any advice you'd want to leave our listeners with, basically, is what I'm asking?
Yeah, one of them is, like I said, don't treat the robot like another piece of equipment. And I think that's too often what people do is they go out, they spend the money on it, they think of it as a piece of equipment, they park in the operating room, and it's there for surgeons if they need it, as opposed to really think of it as a highly complex computer interface between a surgeon's hands and the patient's body. It's really something different. And so it's too often I see people blaming the technology for any perceived shortcoming of robotics. And really the shortcomings may simply be about how we organize around the technology. The other thing I probably would recommend to people, and that is that, you know, for surgeons, don't dabble in robotics. You know, if you're going to do it, do it. And one of the things that, another thing that we found when we were studying this, and we were able to show that the surgeons who were the busiest on robotics were also had the lowest complications, the lower length of stay, the lower costs, and the lower readmission. And so that was another eye opener for us. And that is that, you know, a lot of medical staff sometimes will put certain credentialing requirement and privileging requirements of a minimum number. And they'll say, you know, you have to perform a minimum of 2 robotic cases a year to maintain your privileges in this. And so some surgeons will go out there, they don't want to lose the privilege. So they'll go out there and they'll do their 2 cases a year. It's just not enough. And robotics is, it really is something you have to work on, and you have to practice and be able to improve on over time. And it's always nice to be involved in a program, an active program, because you're getting feedback on your performance. And so I just tell people, look, if you're going to do it, do it. Don't be a dabbler in it. Don't do your 2 cases a year. If you're only going to do 2 cases a year, don't do any cases a year. It's really not worth it. If you're going to do it, be committed to it and making sure that you're getting feedback on your performance. And the best way to do it, I could think of, is to build a program and have that program giving everybody who participates feedback on performance. And so that's another big thing that it was big watch out was just, you know, like I said, don't think that piece of equipment sitting in your operating room is going to create all these great outcomes. The great outcomes are around the people who get involved in it, who participate, and who want to make it into something very special.
I think that's a great place to close out our conversation. Thank you so much, Dr. Loftus. I really, really appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you, Brian. Have a great day.
Absolutely. And for our listeners, this podcast is brought to you by Becker's Healthcare in conjunction with Intuitive. Intuitive is a global technology leader and pioneer of robotic-assisted surgery. If you have any feedback on this program or requests for future podcast topics, please email me at bzimmerman@beckershealthcare.com. Thank you and have a great rest of your day.